This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Bloomberg Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
We live in a political world.
And he is living in a political world. We're all living in a political world. We're especially happy that Matthew Phillips, who's usually down in Washington, is here with us in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio.
I just got the alert on my phone that Matthew's
buzzing,
here.
All the buzzing
here.
You're hearing.
Don't
Matthew's
worry,
here.
It's a test. Don't
it's a
worry.
Test, but Matthew is here. He is politics and policy editor for Bloomberg Business Week. And as I said, he is right here with us. So,
yes.
Matthew, nothing going on as it relates to politics
or
policy.
Can I just say
the Supreme Court and perhaps the tax situation of our sitting president or
yeah.
I mean, that's it. There's like, I look at the menu and the top menu and there's just, you know, it's all stories out of Washington. What do you think is the one that investors should be focusing on right now?
Oh, between the two, between Kavanaugh and the
or if there's
tax situation.
One we're missing.
Yeah, is there one we're missing?
Well, what do we think about the yield curve? No, just kidding. I'm in New York here, so it's a little bit in the ether.
Wall Street joke.
So look, I mean, the market keeps going up, and so they seem quite happy with the new trade deal.
Right.
NAFTA by another name. By all accounts, it looks quite similar to what we already have on the books, and investors are happy about that. Whether this continues into the new year and the tax cuts for corporations are going to continue with us seems to, you know, be up in the air, but so far everybody seems happy, at least about the tax, about the trade deal.
What question about the trade deal? How worried should investors be, if at all, that this doesn't make it through Congress?
That's a great point, right? And this isn't going to be something that's going to be passed by this Congress. This is going to be passed by the next one. It seems highly likely. So I think because it's so similar to the current deal, I think that there's a good chance that it's going to go through.
Interesting. All right. So Kavanaugh latest, as we say, what's going on? What should we expect next?
Well, we're still in the aftershock of the president's remarks last night, seeming to call into question and, come at Dr. Ford for really the first time.
Let's be fair. He mocked her.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
And after Monday in that press conference where he came out and seemed supportive of her or saying that she seemed credible?
He against his previous, by all accounts, what has been a trigger finger to go after political enemies, he kind of held fire for a long time on her. And it was only a matter of time, really, before we saw what happened last night. We've seen the three crucial senators, Murkowski, Flake, and Susan Collins, come out and denounce those comments. Sarah Sanders, from the podium in the White House, has said he was just laying out the facts, that it was not a political hit on Dr. Ford. But that's not, I think, how a lot of the world is seeing it. And certainly the three key members that will make or break this nomination are seeing it. The three Republican senators.
And it really does just come down to these three by most accounts, right?
By math. This, yeah. That's right. So if Flake goes, you get one more. And if either Collins or Murkowski go, assuming none of the Democrats vote, which is an open question.
Yeah. Manchin, still a bit of an open question. What do we think?
Well, so Manchin came out and said something to the effect of, you know, no man really truly understands the trauma that a woman goes through in an assault like this.
Mm-hmm.
You can read between the lines of what that means. But the math is tight regardless. And they can lose one and still get Mike Pence to cast the deciding vote. Anything short of that, on the Republican side at least, this thing doesn't happen.
What are the political ramifications, Matthew, of all of this? Because I've heard folks say that New York Times deep dive into the Trump family taxes, if you will, that with his political base, for mm-hmm. Trump's base, it really doesn't mean anything. And I'm just curious, a win or loss of Kavanaugh, how this plays out too.
So you're exactly right. And what we saw last night and what we've seen at a lot of these rallies in very red states were the president playing to his base. And what's amazing about what he did in 2016 was expand beyond that base. And what's even more amazing, as he gets pushed and pushed into this kind of political corner, he has narrowed his message to this section of the electorate that will never leave him, that basically says the media is out for him, the rich and the elite are out for him. Never mind that this kind of undercuts his self-made man kind of story that he's sold so well during his career and also on the campaign. Whether this, you know, further leads independents to leave, you know, him and thus the party in the midterms is really the question. And he's underwater in a lot of states and a lot of polls. And I think in the minds of a lot of people, this only confirms this notion that the story of Donald Trump as self-made man, as, you know, expert businessman and deal maker, is not quite what it has been sold as.
It is interesting. It will be interesting to see how it plays out over the next couple of days, how much it becomes fodder for the campaign trail, you know, for Democrats using it. Democrats seem to be trying to choose what may be, you know, the most potent of their arguments, because they are, in fact, it seems, in almost every case, running against the president, not necessarily running against their
right.
opponent.
And let's be clear, there are political ramifications and legal ramifications, right? The New York State tax officials have said they're going to look into this. There is no statute of limitation when it comes to civil tax cases. Generally speaking, it looks like this is too old to lead to any sort of criminal inquiry. And this, as the piece so well lays out, there is a very murky line between tax avoidance and tax evasion, and it has to do with intent.
Right.
Now, that's the legal side of this. The political side of this, again, as we kind of laid out, is a little bit more baked, and it only kind of skews things in the way that they're already starting to skew.
Right. Matthew Phillips.
Only Wednesday.
Always breaking it down for us. We love having him on the weekend show, and
yes.
It is terrific to have you here with us.
Come on down, he's on down, he's on down the road. Come on, he's on down, he's
well,
on
as Carol Masser portrays it, we're all going to be easing down the road, reading books, texting, whatever we want to do. Someone else is going to be driving the car. The car is going to be driving itself. Big news in that corner of the world and in Detroit today. GM announcing a tie-up with Honda, kind of the first of its kind, really an evolution of a lot of the deals that we've been seeing and big news in the self-driving game. Our own David Weston spoke with GM President Dan Amon earlier. Here's what he had to say about the GM Honda deal.
Well, our mission is to deploy this technology safely at massive scale, and having another partner on board that brings tremendous resources to the equation is another big step in that direction. You know, SoftBank invested $2.25 billion. Honda's bringing $2.75 billion to the table, and you know, a huge amount of engineering resources, and we're full speed ahead.
You talked earlier about the purpose built. When you say purpose, what is the purpose for autonomous driving? That is to say, we won't have a steering wheel?
One of the constraints we're now able to release is that we won't have a driver in the car, we won't have driver controls, and so that allows us to set aside, you know, decades and decades of automotive design, completely reimagine what a car can look like, how it can be used, and how efficient it can be. And so that this is the first time that anyone will be doing that, you know, for a vehicle that's ready to be deployed at massive scale.
Well, this new automobile that's produced by the joint venture, as I understand, General Motors is going to be the manufacturer, will be sold by Cruise, will be sold by a new joint venture, will be sold individually by Honda and General Motors?
It's actually going to be operated on the Cruise network. So the initial deployment of this will be in a network-controlled environment. The vehicles will be owned and operated on the Cruise network.
That was General Motors President Dan Amon speaking earlier with our David Weston over on the Bloomberg TV side. Hey, let's bring in Jamie Butters, U.S. Autos Editor at Bloomberg News from our Detroit Bureau. So was this a bit of a surprise, this collaboration between GM and Honda?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It was a big surprise because Honda had been talking with Waymo and had been sort of public about it. And Waymo, of course, is the former Google self-driving car project. Pretty far advanced, one of the most, probably the most advanced system in the world. They have a deal with Fiat Chrysler to supply plug-in hybrid minivans that they then equip with their software and have those out on the road and are doing some, you know, demos of, like a ride-hailing only without paying for the rides in Phoenix. And so, you know, Honda had been talking with Waymo. It looked like maybe they would have a similar deal to Fiat Chrysler, maybe something more. But then here they are this morning in Detroit announcing this big tie-up with GM. It's not just a little one-off. I mean, they're going to put billions of dollars. Yeah.
Yeah, this feels like a big deal. And so, Jamie, give us some context across the world of cars. You look at it very holistically. These tie-ups don't normally happen. You know, sometimes people collaborate on an engine or something like this. This is much more holistic, it feels like.
Well, it definitely feels more strategic, you know, because this is one of, you know, a big emerging field in the auto industry. One of the big things that's, you know, disrupting the industry as we know it, as I've covered it for the last two decades. And, you know, and so there's a lot of money, as we've quoted, you know, Alex Partners and others. There are going to be billions of dollars wasted as people try to figure out how to make a business out of autonomous vehicles and out of electrification. Honda has actually one of the pretty advanced semi-autonomous systems, the driver assist systems that keep your vehicle in the lane and keep you from running into the car ahead of you. They're very far along on that, but clearly they didn't feel like they could get all the way to self-driving on their own, and they wanted to team up with someone else. And you know, so this, you know, $3 billion almost that they're going to hand over to a competitor to say, we're with you.
It's interesting, too. It comes on a day. There's another story on the Bloomberg that talks about, first it was America's best-selling electric car. Then it became the best-selling luxury car. Now, against all odds, Tesla's Model 3 is becoming one of the best-selling sedans in America, period. You know, so it's interesting. I'm just watching everybody jockeying in the EV and self-driving space. You know, all of this stuff going on. Do we know who is going to be a leader, or will there be multiple players?
In 30 seconds or less,
John.
Well, I think you've hit the three big ones, right? Waymo is very big. They're very far advanced. All the money in the world from Google. GM has really distinguished itself among, you know, the traditional automakers, getting Honda to buy in with them, and the money from SoftBank. If they stay on track, it's $5 billion that's coming out of other folks. That should give GM a fighting chance to get there. And then, you know, Tesla has had a lot of troubles, a lot of ups and downs, but they are somewhat of an automaker at this point, and they are very much a tech-type company, and a lot of their potential, you know, they could be real leaders in that. They've got a lot of problems to solve first, but that's what they do. That's what Elon does, right?
Yeah. See, with seconds to spare. Jamie Butters, thank you. U.S. Autos editor at Bloomberg News from our bureau in Detroit. GM shares, by the way, are up 2.7%. I've got a thing for my laptop computer. We're talking a lot about technology this week because there's a lot going on. You had HP, an event to launch some PCs, Microsoft talking about upgrades. That happened earlier this week. And then tomorrow you've got BlackBerry hosting an event and some news out of Dell today. So let's make some sense of it all. Morgan Stanley also sounding the alarm on semis again today. Bob O'Donnell is president and chief analyst at Technalysis Research, based in Foster City, California, in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio in New York on this Wednesday. Nice to have you in studio. We're always talking to you on the
phone. Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks, Carol.
You've had a busy week, a lot of hardware stuff. What is it that our audience and investors need to know from what you've seen?
You know, look, it's an interesting time for the PC market. You know, a market, obviously, a lot of people wrote off as being dead many years ago. It's actually doing some pretty interesting things. In fact, Intel recently has talked about how they're facing chip shortages because the PC market is doing better than it expected. And so what's really happening is we're sort of in this renaissance of PCs, and we're starting to see these really beautiful, elegant machines that people actually would like to carry around. So HP kicked things off this week here in New York.
But when you say by carrying around, you mean laptops.
They're laptops, yes, to be clear. Yeah, to be clear. That's where most of the action is. I mean, there's a lot of other things going on in the desktop. Gaming PCs are huge because of, you know, all the professional esports sort of stuff.
That's Fortnite, Fortnite.
Oh, my God. I can't get my 25-year-old even off of that thing. But anyway, so HP kicked things off this week. They had this beautiful leather, not just leather wrapped, but the case itself is a beautiful leather notebook PC. It's really pretty clever. It's called the Spectre Folio. So they've had this Spectre line for a while, and it's done quite well for them. It's a what they call convertible, where you can, you know, kind of flip the screen around in different ways. This one is new variation on the theme. Not only is it this beautiful case that the guts of the PC are built into, but in addition, they have this clever mode where you can pull the screen forward instead of flipping it around, you know, as you typically do with these things. It's just a little bit easier. Bottom line, it's a luxurious thing. It's so funny because I wrote a column on this week where all these guys have been talking about the experience of using a device, but they're really talking, it's sort of touchy-feely stuff, but also just what it's like in general. But now you literally have the experience of holding and carrying and working with this beautiful leather device. And I thought it was actually pretty clever and pretty interesting. I mean, look, speeds and feeds, you know, nobody cares as much anymore. So it's this kind of stuff that's interesting.
All right, so I got to ask you, and this falls under the category of Carol Masser, who is fond of saying, wait, what? That was my reaction to, there's a big BlackBerry event going on. Wait, what?
I know. So the BlackBerry event is tomorrow. It's what they're calling a security summit. So you got to think about BlackBerry very differently than we traditionally have, right? BlackBerry is an IoT security company. Remember that they
Internet of Things.
Yes. Sorry. Thank you. Internet of Things. And that touches a lot of areas, including automotive. In fact, one of the hidden gems that BlackBerry owns is an operating system called QNX. And QNX is not a visible thing that you see, but it's an ultra, ultra reliable system that car manufacturers use for all, you know, behind the scenes in the cars. You know, the interface you see on top may be Apple CarPlay or Google or the vendor's own.
You're saying about what makes the car actually work.
The stuff that actually makes the car work and has to be rock solid reliable is QNX. It's also used in other things like airplanes and other areas, critical industrial environments. So because of that heritage and because of all the security heritage of BlackBerry, they are really positioning themselves as this kind of security software provider. They're even leveraging the good old NOCs, their network operation centers that they had that made BlackBerry email so secure. They're using those for these security solutions for IoT.
That's a big enough business, isn't it?
It is a big enough business, and that's been how they've, you know, evolved themselves. Interestingly, they still haven't given up on the phones.
Right. I mean, it is amazing, though, you know, as I looked at our notes coming into this segment, it's like, Bob O'Donnell's going to talk about HP, Microsoft, and BlackBerry. It's like, and apparently it's 2004. Like,
no, right.
I know. Well, it is interesting. I mean, and, you know, it's very interesting to see how these companies have evolved. I mean, going back to HP.
Well, they had to either evolve or you're not going to survive.
Well, and what's fascinating about HP, just quickly, is remember when they split, everybody said, E is going to kill it and Inc is dead.
That's right.
Well, guess what? The exact opposite, frankly, has happened. Inc has been doing very well on top of this, you know, robust PC business that's still there and the printing side. You know, and then Microsoft. Microsoft has done a fantastic job of repositioning themselves as a, interestingly enough, more of a platform agnostic company than you would ever think, even though they own a platform.
Isn't that amazing?
One of the things they talked about at this event, which, by the way, had new Surface PCs and Surface Studio, you know, some of their new Surface devices, but they also had new things in Windows 10 and in Office 365 that are really geared to get you to work more efficiently with other non-Windows devices, namely Android phones in particular, and a little bit with iOS as well. So very interesting to see how we have seen these companies evolve.
Well with our sticking with that theme of Flashback Wednesday, let's talk a little bit about Dell, because there's a story on the Terminal that says it met with its banks about an IPO contingency plan. So if it does not ultimately go public once again, you know, they're looking at other plans. Where does Dell fit into all of this?
Look, and here's another great example of a company that so many people wrote off. And Michael Dell has pulled off, frankly, you know, what some would argue is a sort of a financial miracle in what he's been able to do. When they merged with EMC and they built around all of this, you know, what a lot of people considered old school server data center business, they've still managed to keep themselves very relevant, in part because, of course, the reality is what people think is happening and what actually happens, you know, in businesses isn't always quite as fast, right? Yes, people are moving to the cloud, but they still have big data centers that they're using and they need equipment and providers. And what Dell has particularly done has been able to take pieces of critical software. There, the efforts, obviously, with VMware is a huge deal, but there are other these smaller software companies they've bought over the years, Boomi and other companies, that actually do some pretty amazing things. And so they're putting together entire packages, entire solutions around some of these complex problems that businesses have.
Like software as a service, right?
So they're doing some software as a service. They're doing a whole variety of different things, you know.
You're going to ask about chips? We only have 40 seconds.
So in 40 seconds or less, chips, are we scared that the cycle is going to turn, or is the cycle no longer relevant?
Well, look, there's a lot of debate there. I don't think it'll turn because there are still a lot of devices. If you look at what Intel's saying, look, they're having a hard time even supplying chips. Devices continue to sell. IoT is driving the use of more and more chips.
Right.
They're cheaper ones, but I still think there's plenty of opportunity.
I got a chip in me right now.
There you go. Okay. Exactly.
That's how she does it. That's the secret, folks. We've been wondering. That is the secret. Bob O'Donnell, President, Chief Analyst, Technalysis Research, based in Foster City, California, but here with us in our
nice
Bloomberg Interactive
so
Broker Studio.
Thanks, guys.
That was a great tour of like tech.
I know.
On a Way Back Wednesday.
We're so lucky that we caught him.
See, I tweaked it Way Back Wednesday.
Way Back Wednesday.
It's WW. Instead of Throwback Wednesday.
Oh,
we're just workshopping it. We're workshopping it here.
You want to take us out?
Yes, I will. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week on Bloomberg Radio with Jason Kelly and Carol Masson.
Strong, baby. From that vending machine, on top of
so companies are increasingly using the cloud and software to change how they conduct business and how they kind of move money around, if you will. Carla Friede is founder and CEO at InvoicePay, based in Portland, Oregon, in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio here in New York City. Welcome to Bloomberg Radio.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. Tell us a little bit about what you guys are doing. It's all payment automation software that you do.
It is. And in the business world, payment automation is a new category. I know that sounds incredible because as consumers, everybody can pick up their phone and pay anybody they want. But the reality of business payments is really different. It's archaic. It's paper bound. So the first solutions that came to the market, you know, 20 years ago, really added more inefficiencies than they solved. So they put more work on the teams paying those invoices. So payment automation is relatively new. So this is the first time businesses can simply send their invoices to somebody and say, pay it and have it done without touching anything.
I have to say, I actually worked for a company that my mom worked with, like as a high school student and as a college student, and would be put in like accounts receivable, accounts payable, and was handwriting checks and doing things. It was so manual, and these old computer systems with like I don't know whether it was like a tape that you would feed through. Like it's amazing. I mean, it's a few years ago, but
it's kind of shocking, but it hasn't changed that much.
Yeah. I was going to say I didn't think it had.
Right.
And so, what was the catalyst? I mean, was it just a matter of time that companies had to catch up with where consumers were, or was there's some sort of little mini revolution or some catalyst that caused it that companies to do it?
I think there's a couple things that have gone on. One, you know, the expectation in the consumer space that there should be an easier way to do things. I think, two, the cloud and the technology bringing the cost down so companies like InvoicePay can afford to add the services that are required to make customers successful. So in business-to-business payments, you have to collect the data on who you're paying. You have to validate it, securely store it, and so that your customer doesn't have to do that work and doesn't have to touch it. And I think it wasn't until the cloud came along that it lowered the cost enough so companies like InvoicePay could try to do this. And I think before that, it was kind of the path of least resistance. Tech companies went to consumer payments, which was a little bit easier. It was more scalable, less heavy lifting. So as consumer payments have become more saturated, and I think payment companies are looking around, and now B2B payments has become really a hot space.
I'm curious, too. You guys are working globally, correct? Or no?
No. Well, we send payments globally, but our customers were focused on U.S.-based customers.
Because is it more complicated to kind of get into other markets because of that? Because of different...
For us, it's been... There's so much demand here in the U.S. that we are going as fast as we can and growing as fast as we can to keep up with U.S. demand. So for us, it's such a big market in the U.S.
Right.
It's so paper-based that there isn't really a reason to go somewhere else.
Who's your typical customer? Is it a small-sized company? Is it a mid-sized company?
We serve large enterprises. So when we started, we thought those were the ones who would have the solution solved, but they kind of came to us. And in for large enterprises, they have a much more complex problem because they have, you know, multiple locations, multiple hierarchies. They may have companies, divisions, sectors.
Right.
And so the complication of having visibility across all that makes it much tougher. So we serve those large enterprise companies, and we give them the visibility and the control over all their payments.
So you yourself have worked in companies large and small. You're a bit of a serial entrepreneur of late. Why Portland? What's the scene like there, and how is it out there for an entrepreneur? We can't have an entrepreneur in studio with us without like getting the juice.
So Portland is a great place to grow a company. It's a tough place to start a company because it doesn't have the breadth and depth of venture capital of a place like Silicon Valley or Seattle. But Portland is a great place to grow a company because people are really committed to what they do. They like being there. They want to be part of something. So while I was a little jealous of my Silicon Valley peers when I started, I feel really good about what we're building and the company that we can build in Portland.
Right, because you did a tour down in Silicon Valley. You previously worked down there, right?
Or no? I was a consultant for a long time, and most of our clients were in the Bay Area. So I spent 5 years doing that. So I kind of feel like during those years I was in the Bay Area.
Hey, Carla, just got about 40 seconds left here, though. Is it getting more expensive, though, to run a business in Portland? And I'm just curious about access to workers. Is there a lot of competition?
There's still a lot of great talent in Portland. I hate to say that because maybe other companies are going to move there.
They're going to listen. There's a ton of talent. They're headed your way. Well, very good. Carla Friede, founder and chief executive officer of InvoicePay, based out in Portland, Oregon, as we've been discussing, here with us today in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Time for the Drive to the Close. Willie Delwich is Managing Director, Investment Strategist over at Bayer, joining us on the phone from Milwaukee. Willie, good to have you here with Jason and myself. Tell me a little bit about the market internals, because I was looking over your research note, and you talk a lot about what we're seeing in terms of the major equity averages overall versus what we're seeing when you look internally in terms of stocks hitting highs or lows, what it tells us about maybe the market.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We've got, you know, the Dow making a new high today, but you look inside, you've got almost four times as many stocks on the NYSE making new lows as new highs, and it's not just interest related issues, because if you look on the Nasdaq as well, you've got more lows than new highs. So you've really got a market right now where if you look at the indexes, in just the indexes, things look okay, but you start to peel it back and look inside, and it's getting pretty narrow in terms of participation and not real healthy at this point.
And when you narrow down and you start to look at what sectors may still have some room to run in this market, what do you focus on?
Well, the areas, some of the rotation you've seen in terms of leadership, you start to see technology and discretionary lose a step, but stepping into leadership is healthcare and industrials. So from a perspective of industrials, that's encouraging because that suggests that the good news that we're getting from the economy is maybe something that can stick around for a while. So,
well, it's also interesting, too, that you're taking a look at what's going on with the U.S. markets versus other global markets, making the point that, you know, historically, when we've got a bull market, they're typically global in scope.
Very much so. And that's whether you're looking at the economy or looking at the markets, the U.S. is kind of an island right now. Good economic news in the U.S., not so great economic news overseas. U.S. markets making new highs. By and large, you're not seeing that around the rest of the world.
But that does that say to you that you've got investors being discretionary in terms of really trading on fundamentals, looking at the specific markets rather than just throwing money at everything and saying everything looks good?
That's a positive way of looking at it. it would be better, though, to have the global economy doing better with the U.S. economy and the global markets doing better. And so I guess the question is, does the rest of the world catch up to the U.S., or does the U.S. need to catch down to the rest of the world? Mm. That's still to be seen, but that I think is the kind of the tension that's out there right now.
So, Willie, I want to ask you a question, because I was peering at your Twitter feed, and one of the things you retweeted — I know retweets are not endorsements, but I wanted to ask you about this, because you retweeted something from Cliff Asness, who's someone we talk to fairly often, talking about the move by Amazon to raise the minimum wage to $15. More news on that today, with sort of how they're going to pay for it. Setting that aside, how do you look at a market move like that? Because it is a broader market move that may play through from a wage perspective.
I don't want to get too much into, company-specific issues, but I think it's a good PR move from Amazon's perspective. They, if they're going to do it, then they can encourage a federal law to raise the minimum wage, and then that plays to their benefit. I think they're already going to be raising their wages, and that puts pressure on some of their competition. So I think that's wise from that perspective. I've got personal opinions that aren't here or there about the minimum wage issues, but from a political perspective, it makes sense for them to, having done it, to encourage Congress to get behind a national minimum wage.
And, maybe the story is going to be that we're going to start talking more and more about wage increases at companies and what that's going to do to their cost equation, and what that does then ultimately to their profit equation, and then what that does to how they perform, certainly for public companies, how they perform in the stock market. Are we getting to that point?
That is very much the focus right now, from my perspective, is we've got record profit margins, and if you see wages start to move higher, and it's not just this news on Amazon, you see it elsewhere. Commodity prices moving higher, with oil doing what it's doing. You've got interest costs moving higher. I think the story as we go into earnings season is going to be what are companies saying about current profit margins and what that means going forward, and whether or not they need to start to tamp down some of the really positive expectations that are out there for earnings growth.
Great stuff. Willie Delwich, you are Managing Director and Investment Strategist at Baird, joining us on the phone from Milwaukee. Great to have you with us. So, Carol, just taking a look at, as you said, markets off their highs, but also wanted to take a look at what people are reading here on the Bloomberg. Interestingly, Amazon is right at the top over the last hour. That news today, we've only talked about it briefly. Warehouse workers losing their bonuses and stock awards in order to pay for those raises that we were just talking about with Willie. So maybe all of that PR, good PR that they got yesterday, may be going away when it becomes clear how they're going to pay for it.
Yeah, it's just kind of interesting. And whether this is a balance sheet maneuver, or whether, this is putting more money into the pockets of their workers, I guess we'll have to see what exactly it all means. But it's
looks like they may have some splaining to do, though.
Some splaining to do. Yeah. Well, some will say that you put it into their paychecks, and it means it's kind of a guaranteed money going forward. Raises are, keyed off of that. A bonus is discretionary.
That's absolutely true.
Or can be.
It just feels like that maybe that it doesn't feel good.
No,
I don't have a good technical, economic, or fiscal explanation for this, other than like,
it just seemed a little
feels
odd.
So great if now I'm going to lose my bonus in order to get a higher paycheck.
Wait, what? Amazon shares, by the way, they were up as much as about 0.9%. Now they're down about 0.8%, trading at $1,954.49 a share. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week on Bloomberg Radio.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show every weekday at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.